Rwanda-backed rebels in Congo aim for the capital.
We will continue the March of Liberation all the way to Kinshasa.
More bodies have been recovered as an investigation continues into a deadly mid-air plane and helicopter collision in Washington.
I have taken a look at the data online, the radar data, and pulled down a lot of the audio from air traffic control.
Join us now on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
I'm Scott Walterman with Lori London in Washington.
It is a very serious problem.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
It is a very serious problem.
President Trump commenting on the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the rebel group M23 has captured the eastern city of Goma and plan to take their fight to the far-off capital, Kinshasa.
Congo's president has called for a massive military mobilization to resist the rebellion, and his defense minister rejected calls for talks. Another player is Rwandan President Paul Kagame. He has backed the M23 rebels, and Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham reports Kagame says he's ready for any confrontation.
The long simmering conflict in Congo has intensified over the last week, with M23 rebels capturing the strategic city of Goma. Congo, South Africa, and others accuse Rwanda of backing M23. Kagame has rejected criticism over his country's role in the conflict. During a virtual summit of East African leaders, Kagame accused South African President Cyril Ramaphosa of distorting recent conversations about the conflict.
He's also there pretending to be playing a peacemaker role, and he has a force that has been fighting alongside FDLR and has been fighting the M23 on the instructions of Tshisekedi, because these are people who are not supposed to be in Congo, that these are from Rwanda, or the M23 are not Rwandans, please.
Congo President Felix Tshisekedi did not attend the virtual summit. Instead, he gave a speech to the nation in which he promised a military campaign to recover lost territory. Rwanda is facing an international backlash over its actions in eastern Congo. It has repeatedly intervened there, either directly or through allied militias, over the past 30 years in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. The United States has told Rwanda it is deeply troubled by Goma's fall. Germany has cancelled aid talks with Rwanda, while Britain said the $40 million of annual bilateral assistance it gives to Kigali were under threat. After seizing Goma, M23 fighters were advancing south from the town of Minova along the western side of Lake Kivu. Goma itself is a lakeside city of nearly 2 million and a major hub for displaced people and aid groups. M23 says it plans to administer the city and appears to be settling in for a lengthy period of control. Scores of Congolese asylum seekers who fled to Rwanda during recent fighting are returning home, following assurances of safety from the rebel group.
That's Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham reporting. Now, you heard Rachel mention that M23 has taken control of Goma and plans on running it. Reuters correspondent David Doyle reports building an administration in Goma could be the key to the success of their entire offensive.
Rwandan-backed rebels appear keen to show they can not only seize the biggest city in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, but also govern it. That's a stark contrast to the last time M23 took Goma, back in 2012. Then they withdrew a few days later. But this time, how well the rebels can maintain order and run services in a city of 2 million people could be key to determining if their offensive expands or is doomed to failure.
Nous allons assurer, nous le faisons déjà.
At a press conference, Corne Nangaa, head of the Congo River Alliance that includes M23, said they had found Goma to be a wounded city, traumatized and fearful.
We are here in Goma to stay as Congolese and to protect the population against threats. We will continue the march of liberation all the way to Kinshasa.
The former president of Congo's election commission pledged to get children back in school within 48 hours and to open a humanitarian corridor so displaced people could return home. Since Goma's capture, power and mobile data services, which had been down for days, have also returned. The border with Rwanda, a lifeline for the city, has reopened. And M23 officials said they had trained up hundreds of administrators who were ready to deploy. However, the World Food Programme has expressed concern over the lack of aid access to Goma and surrounding displacement camps. It warned that people are running out of food, medical care and drinking water. On Thursday, these Goma residents were turning to Lake Kivu after fighting disrupted the city's water supplies. Conscience Mapendo said he was praying this would be his last trip.
Because we, the people, are the ones they came to govern. And without water, we cannot live. They must do everything possible to restore our water supply.
What's at stake is a potential return to the situation that arose in the 1990s and 2000s. Back then, Rwanda, Uganda and their proxy forces occupied and ran Congo's mineral-rich eastern borderlands, managing trade, communications and transport. In the 3 years since M23 reignited its rebellion, having been dormant for a decade, it set up parallel administrations in areas it's conquered, UN experts said in June. That involved taxing civilians and businesses and rolling out intelligence networks. In December, UN experts said the insurgents had generated an income of $800,000 per month after taking control of Rubaya, the largest coltan mine in the country. But Goma, with its population size, international airport and role as a hub for one of the world's biggest humanitarian crises, remains a far greater challenge.
That was David Doyle with Reuters reporting.
Let's get some insights into this evolving situation with Michelle Gavin, a senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
First of all, if you can just kind of explain what is happening in Goma and what is this fighting all about?
What's happening is that the city of Goma, which is a very significant city in terms of population and is the capital of North Kivu, has fallen to the M23 rebel group. Now, Eastern Congo has been dealing with insecurity for many decades, and there are many armed groups that operate there. So this is not, the whole story about security in Eastern Congo, but this is the crisis of the moment. The M23 is a rebel group that is backed by Rwanda. There's evidence, too, of backing from Uganda. And they have seized Goma before in 2012. They claim that their aim is to go all the way to Kinshasa and to essentially overthrow the government there. But what's happening right now is they are moving into South Kivu toward Bukavu, which is the capital of South Kivu. And these are two provinces that are very rich in minerals. So why is this happening? Well, there are multiple threads to pull there. First, you have the government of Rwanda claiming that it has legitimate security concerns about Eastern Congo. They share a border, obviously. And to the extent that Rwanda even acknowledges its military presence in the region and support for the M23, the reasoning is that this is necessary to protect Rwanda and particularly to go after the FDLR, which is sort of what's left of the genocidal regime responsible for the tragedy of 1994. And that it's necessary to protect ethnic Tutsis who live in eastern Congo and protect them from persecution. But there also is a great deal of evidence that some of these very lucrative minerals in eastern Congo are mined there, taken across the border to Rwanda, and then sold. So there are clear economic imperatives here as well.
The Republic is very large. I mean, they're vowing to go to the capital, but that's all the way on the other side of a very big country.
That's right. It's a huge country. I mean, it has happened before, right? The fall of Mobutu occurred with a movement that began in the east and essentially swept through the country. But it's not at all clear that this is a similar set of circumstances. You have a great deal of anti-Rwanda sentiment in Congo. There's a lot of nationalist sentiment, a lot of frustration with the violations of Congolese sovereignty. So I don't think it would be as easy as it was when you had a population exhausted by the Mobutu years. But perhaps, you know, perhaps this is rhetoric. Perhaps it's a real ambition. It's very difficult to know.
What are other countries saying about this?
Well, there are a number of countries with very clear stakes here. So fighting alongside the Congolese forces who lost Goma, you have militia forces, Congolese militia forces, but also some Burundian troops. You had peacekeepers attempting not to fight on one side or the other, but to de-escalate conflict and provide security, both from a UN mission and from a mission from the Southern African Development Community. And over a dozen peacekeepers have been killed in this latest advance. So you have, for example, quite a number of South African peacekeepers killed, and you've seen escalatory, very bellicose rhetoric from President Ramaphosa and President Kagame about this issue. So you have those increasing tensions. So you have a lot of concern among African leaders. Kenyan President Ruto has tried to mediate. President Lourenco of Angola has been engaged in a long but unfortunately failed mediation. And then you have broader global leaders, many of whom are now saying Rwanda needs to stop its support for M23. But what we saw the last time the M23 took Goma was that what it took was to threaten aid flows to Rwanda, to threaten sanctions, and really go beyond sort of shaming rhetoric to change the calculus in Kigali.
You know, you mentioned Burundi. I believe they have thousands of troops inside Congo, right? They're
yes.
hunting down rebels. If this fighting, if M23 takes on those troops, might that spark a regional war?
Absolutely. I think I can drum up about 10 scenarios at this point that could spark a regional war. It is an incredibly tense situation because there are so many troops operating in eastern Congo, Burundians, Ugandans, Rwandans, South Africans. You had Romanian mercenaries working on the side of the Congolese government. So there are a lot of ways that this escalates, and you know, it's any escalation, I think, is very, very unlikely to be contained within Congo's borders.
And of course, that seems like it would potentially, or would it potentially lead to yet another global humanitarian crisis?
Well, absolutely, and you know, the DRC is already in terrible humanitarian crisis. The number of displaced people in Congo is second only to Sudan. So more displaced than Ukrainians or Gazans. It's so over 21 million people need humanitarian assistance. It's already in crisis, and this is just exacerbating an already very, very difficult situation.
Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London with Scott Walterman. Fire and emergency service officials in Washington say more bodies have been recovered from the wreckage of a commercial passenger jet and a military helicopter that collided and crashed into the Potomac River late Wednesday, killing 67 people.
The National Transportation Safety Board reported late Thursday that the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder from the airliner have been recovered and are at the agency's labs for evaluation as the investigation moves forward. Here's NTSB Chair Jennifer Homand.
We have about nearly 50 people on scene, and in addition to our resources back at headquarters in our labs and throughout the agency.
Divers are working to salvage both aircraft and find additional components.
For more on what goes into an investigation like this, we're joined by William Angeli, an aviation crash attorney and former Navy pilot who's flown more than 1,000 hours in various types of military airplanes and helicopters.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us about this. We appreciate hearing your expertise. What can you tell us about what we know so far, and if you can also maybe break down the process of the investigation?
Yeah, I have taken a look at the data online, the radar data, and pulled down a lot of the audio from air traffic control exchanges with both the helicopter and the American Airlines flight, and just kind of listened to what was going on at the time, trying to get a little bit of insight. And a couple of interesting things that I noticed that I haven't seen yet posted in any of the news sources. DC has three runways, Reagan National. Runway 1, they're covering that, is a very long one, and that's the most used because it can be used by the larger jets. Runway 33, which also heads north, but 330, a little bit north and west, is a shorter runway. Most planes were landing on runway 1. But air traffic control, right around the time of this accident, for some reason, was trying to get planes to land on 33. I guess they're trying to lighten the load on runway 1. So what I hear shortly before the crash is there's an American Airlines flight, 5307. They check in with the tower for landing. Tower responds to 5307 and asks, can you land on runway 33? 5307 says, no, unable. So air traffic control tells 5307, go ahead and land on runway 1. Now, 5307 is also a CRJ-700 operated by PSA Airlines as an American Eagle flight, identical to the plane that crashed. So just a couple of minutes after 5307 declines to land on runway 33, flight 5342 checks in with the tower. Tower also asks him, can you land on runway 33? 5342 says, yes, I'm fine landing on runway 33. So tower then clears him to land. So we've got two identical airplanes, one landing almost due north on runway 1, one landing on runway 33, just a little bit north and west, just within a couple of minutes of each other. They're going to look alike. They're going to be the exact same size. At this time, we've got this helicopter, this Army helicopter, coming down the Potomac River. He's on a helicopter route, and it's a published route, and they call it Route 1. And Route 1 comes down the Potomac, kind of, you know, past the mall and then, you know, a little bit south of D.C. It brings those helicopters right across the approach end, the landing end of runway 33 and further down runway 1. But air traffic control was aware of this helicopter being, you know, right there and asked the helicopter pilot, do you see the CRJ? helicopter pilot responds, yes, I see the CRJ. Then air traffic control tells him to pass behind the CRJ. Captain of the helicopter says, okay, fine. So what I'm wondering, we've got two planes in the air at the exact same time. They look alike. The helicopter pilot probably, because, you know, when you're passing this airport, it's going to draw your attention in, right? It's big, it's lit, there's tons of activity. You're going to be looking that way. He saw 5307 and confirms to the tower that he sees the CRJ aircraft. What he didn't see was 5342, which would have been off to his left at the time. And tower didn't tell him that he had two CRJs in the air. He just said, I got one CRJ in the air. Do you see it? And the helicopter confirmed it. And then just a couple of seconds after that, the crash occurs.
So you think both planes, both of the American Airlines planes were in the corridor, but on two different runways?
Yes, yes, at the exact same time. That is what air traffic control audio recordings demonstrate.
So in other words, the air traffic controller confirming with the helicopter that the plane was there, but the helicopter pilot may not have realized there were two planes that were identical.
Exactly. Exactly. Same kind of plane operated by the same aircraft. I mean, to the extent on a dark night you can see any of the markings, these two planes are going to look exactly alike. And so ATC only called out one of them. The helicopter confirmed seeing that. Didn't call out the other one, which was just right there.
Would it have been normal for the controller to say there's two of them in the air?
He should have. I mean, in that close of an airspace. I mean, honestly, to me, the head scratcher for me is what's this helicopter doing in that space at that time to begin with? But putting that aside for a moment, yes, when you're that tightly compressed, you would say you've got a CRJ landing on runway 1, you've got a CRJ landing on runway 33. Do you have them both in sight? Is what I would expect.
Why do you say it was unusual for the helicopter to be there?
Well, it's a published route, but, you know, I mean, air traffic control, part of what they do, and these guys are overwhelmed and overloaded, especially at these big airports, but part of what they do is just space traffic out, right? So, you know, I remember when I would fly through busy corridors, you know, they can have you reduce your speed, they can have you make a little circle somewhere out. You know, there's prohibited airspace out there, but, you know, he could have made a circle in another direction, any number of things, either to slow him down or reroute him, you know, around the landing end while these two planes are coming in. Just anything to have affected, you know, the timing of these two airplanes occupying the same space.
How do they conduct they're going to do the same thing you did. They're going to look at the radar data. They're going to listen to the chatter between the controller and the aircraft, right?
Right. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Sure they have. I'm sure they've, you know, I'm sure someone else has put this together. I just haven't seen it posted on the news yet and or the other news outlets. And I thought, you know, that was very interesting. You got two identical planes, same space, same time, basically. And ATC only calls out one. Helicopter confirmed seeing one.
You talked about the controllers being overwhelmed. Are they understaffed? Are they undertrained? President Trump sort of talked about standards, and he pondered the possibility that lowered standards might have contributed?
Not to my knowledge on standards. Understaffed, I think, has been an issue for a while, especially post-COVID. Those numbers never came back to pre-COVID levels. And so I am aware that we are understaffed with, you know, good air traffic controllers at a lot of these airfields. I am not aware that they're undertrained. I think these guys probably do it, you know, generally do a good job and the best job that they can under the circumstances. But this one to me just seems like there's a whole lot going on within about a half a mile space, which in the air is just not very much space. And it just didn't get caught.
William Angeli, an aviation crash attorney and former Navy pilot who has flown more than 1,000 hours in various types of military airplanes and helicopters.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our daily podcast, The Issue. It's available at voanews.com or wherever you get your podcast from.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman in Washington.